Great. Thank you very much, Pat. I'd point out that when we started writing this book, it was some time ago, and we asked Mary Peters to write the foreword for the book, and she gratefully agreed that she would do so. And then just about a week after the book was released, Mary Peters was tapped to be the Secretary of Transportation. So you see, Pat, it's not how many readers you have, it's who those readers are. All right, our next speaker is my colleague, a professor of economics at George Mason University, Dan Klein. Dan has done more than anyone else to shed light on the amazing history of private roads in the United States, a history that is far more extensive than just about anyone realized before Dan's important work in this area. Dan has also done important work on HOT lanes, on improving urban transit, franchising highways, and many other areas. Dan Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's great to be here. It's great to be part of this whole project. Thanks to Alex, thanks to Gabriel, thanks to the Independent Institute. Thank you to you for coming out and listening and participating. When we get out of bed in the morning and go forth in our day with confidence and faith, so much of that faith and confidence comes from our experience, from what we've seen, what we're accustomed to. Sometimes we read about things we haven't actually seen and we believe them, but we maybe have talked to the actual people who have seen them and touched them. People, culture, humanity is really very much experience-oriented. I see it when I believe it. And so it's sometimes hard to get out of the system that you know. That's one reason that travel can be so valuable, because you step into a different system, a different experience, and you see maybe highway facilities that are run differently than you recognize them. History is another way of doing that, but it's a much harder thing to step into. History is really going to be scholarship and imagination, and there's no way other to do it. But history can also be a great teacher of other ways of doing things and really expand our mind about how whole cultures can be oriented very differently than we are. So I want to just briefly tell you about what we can learn from the 19th century American history of private toll road companies. There was an extensive movement throughout the century. We're talking about 100 years experience from the East Coast to the West Coast. That was one which was a lesson in, if you want good highways, turn to private enterprise. And that's what Americans understood very clearly and plainly in the 19th century. This picture here tries to tally roughly all of the roads, all of the miles that were built. It is rough. This is a very spotty kind of research. Most of it's in historical societies, local historical societies, and things like that. It's all very bottom up. Looking at, in particular, three episodes of the 100-year history, it breaks things down and then has another column, all amounting to something like 3,000 private roads that were successfully built and operated, and something like 40,000 miles of private toll roads. This experience, and I'm going to generalize about the 100 years as a whole, although each episode had its distinctiveness, but as a whole, it was generally remarked that private roads were the best roads around. It was often remarked that the private ownership was really necessary to make the best go of it. And historians about the period remark that it was really private enterprise that principally provided the good highways of 19th century America. Now, what were some of the advantages of the toll road? It unified ownership and responsibility for the entire route, and this was something different than the public management at the time. As private owners, they had a sort of decisive authority over the resources and the operation. And they had what economists call residual claimancy. Now, this is a fancy word for something you understand very well in managing your own pocketbook and your own resources in your own home. Residual claimancy is nothing more than a fancy word for the idea that you claim the residuals at the end of the period. The residual is, as it were, the money that's left over. And when that money is positive, we call it profit. When that money is negative, you call it loss. Either way, you have to claim it when you're an owner and a residual claimant. And private toll roads were owned by people who understood residual claimancy. They tasted profit and loss, and this meant they had every incentive to make it profit rather than loss, and to make it larger profit rather than small profit, although, as we'll see, it wasn't generally very profitable. The environment, the regulatory environment, was not laissez-faire. There were controls by the government on, first of all, creating a company. There were controls on the toll rates, and there were important controls on toll collection. It seems that toll evasion at the time was a very significant problem. Evading tolls was sometimes called shunpiking. Mostly these roads were entirely private and voluntary. There was very little government participation in the financing. In a couple of states, the government had a policy of buying some of the stock, but not generally. The companies did enjoy eminent domain privileges, not clear just how important those were. And something I didn't put on this slide, but perhaps should have, is that very often the company was granted an existing roadbed that was public property. So that probably should be added to that slide. But generally, the roads were not profitable. Generally, those residuals were small, if they were even positive. Okay? And yet these roads went forward nonetheless. Because the owners themselves were interested not only in the residuals, the monetary residuals that came from operating a road, but also from the improvement in land values, the improvement in transportation that the facility brought, the increase in population. Indeed, even the pride that such a facility and project brought to the community as a kind of monument to the community. And so very often, I would even say typically, these projects were undertook with a strong spirit of community enterprise, okay, and community pride. And in general, the profits were lacking, and that they were expected, actually, to be meager. So why did people build all these roads? Well, Alexis de Tocqueville, in his famous book, The Democracy in America, put it probably as well as anybody, and he's just said that there's an overwhelming public pride, a civic pride and participation in Americans, which I think is normal to humanity, perfectly normal. He could be quoted at length, but he says that they constantly form associations to build roads, libraries, hospitals, schools, and so on to overcome their community's needs. And so people participated partly out of esteem and interest and altruism, if you will. So buying stock in one of these toll road companies was a lot like contributing to a local charity or a community project. It really shouldn't be seen as a narrow sort of monetary investment the way you might buy something through your Schwab account. However, the companies did still taste profit and loss. Okay, this was way before law separated profit from not-for-profit corporations, and there were still residuals officially. And I think that's an important thing for internal organization of the company. Now today, with modern toll collection, investors can better capture their share of the value created by the road. Okay, there's not going to be shunpiking today on a modern road facility, for example. There's perhaps won't be extensive toll exemptions, and so investors can expect that the value they create is better translated into those positive residuals, and perhaps we should expect it to be more commercially motivated. But we should not neglect the civic impulse that can and does still play a role in modern toll facilities. I was teaching out in Southern California when some of the California toll roads were built, and landowners donated land and were very cooperative in helping to get those projects off the ground because they wanted better transportation. They wanted higher land values. They maybe also wanted the esteem and goodwill of the community. In terms of investment magnitudes, My colleague John Majewski and I did a kind of rough estimate, and we came up with the investment in New England from 1800 to 1830 being about 6.15% of the 1830 GDP for those 10 states, I should say the middle Atlantic states in New England. And that's over a 31-year period, and this exceeds the percentage of GDP for 1995 GDP for the interstate highway system. So through voluntary means, private initiative mustered a larger per capita investment than the interstate highway system did over a 40-year period. Another lesson that comes out of the history, and this speaks to something that Greg mentioned and runs contrary to what Greg suggested, is that private ownership and that kind of decentralized control does not mean a lack of coordination. It does not mean a lack of network integration. This is a map, which I understand you can't make sense of, but many of these roads are called the Great Western, the First Great Western, the Second Great Western, the Third Great Western, and they link up to various other private turnpike companies making a system, a well-known system. This is essentially traveling the Mohawk Valley region that was traveled by the Erie Canal through central New York. And if you look at the construction of these roads, you see that these owners naturally talk to each other. Lo and behold, they said, look, we're thinking of building this road. If you guys in your region build a road and we connect the two pieces together, we're going to be able to make it to the valley at the end of the Appalachian Mountains and so on. And this is exactly what they did. This is the way you build an integrated system. It's really not that different when the government takes responsibility for the entire thing. They have someone focusing on this portion and someone portion, and they get together in a room and they talk and they say, let's make sure someone can go the whole way. And what we have here is just as an illustration is a letter from one fellow writing, trying to start a company in one part of that route you just saw, writing to the one of the leaders of another piece of that route saying, we're thinking about doing this. It'll be greatly beneficial to your community and your road and the whole region and the public at large, as he says, and I hope you will support it. And so they naturally coordinated and integrated. This is really not different than, you know, what happens in the market economy in general. If you think about all the activities that flowed, say, into providing one of those cookies you may have helped yourself to today, and you start thinking about all the different activities of, you know, who brought it here, who packed it, who grew the, who made the flour, who grew the wheat, and so on, you have this, you know, remarkable chain of activities we can hardly even begin to imagine that got coordinated to bring a cookie to us. And it's really not that different in coordinating a road system or a transportation system. We don't need the government to do that particularly. Well, let me bring this down to five lessons for today. One, private toll roads bought quantity, quality. I don't know why this is happening now. Oh, I may have kicked that with my foot. There's a, if we all seem to be oddly postured up here, it's because there's a box directly where we'd like to stand. The private toll roads brought quantity, quality, and efficiency. The virtues of private ownership still recommend private enterprise over government as the way of matching highway supply to demand, I would suggest. Lesson two, overregulation hampered the old toll roads. Regulatory demands for better service and user concessions back then often resulted in worse road conditions or no road at all. Policymakers today must understand the deleterious long-run consequences of restrictions on road companies. That's not to say there shouldn't be any restrictions, but they should be mindful of the deleterious consequences of such restrictions. Three, until the end of the century, the toll road companies were confident in the rules of the game. under which they operated. In modern times, the rules are prone to change harshly and without much warning. To give private investors the confidence, the government must ensure the integrity of the rules by which private enterprise would go forth. Four, modern highways are often plagued by traffic jams, something which wasn't an issue so much in the 19th century. Road officials today can increase flow by setting higher charges. Such charges not only reduce congestion, they help investors identify profitable ways to provide new roads. And finally, the old toll roads assembled their routes swiftly and easily. Today, the process of environmental clearance involves tremendous delays, outlays, and uncertainties. The clearance and entitlement process must somehow be simplified. So I hope that we don't forget that Americans, you know, had a long, rich, successful history with private road provision, and the lessons there have not really changed, because I don't think humanity and society has fundamentally changed. Thank you for your attention.